that I had been waiting at the stop and had got on. That's why the streetcar had stopped. But she stayed up with the driver, talking and joking. I could see them. The streetcar passed one stop after another. No one was waiting to get on. The streets were empty. It was not yet sunrise, and under a colorless sky everything lay pale in the pale light. Buildings, parked cars, the new leaves on the trees and first flowers on the shrubs, the gas tank and the mountains in the distance. The streetcar was moving slowly. Presumably the schedule was based both on stopping times and on the time between each stop, and so the speed of travel had to be slowed down when there were no actual stops. I was imprisoned in the slow-moving car. At first I sat, then I went and stood on the front platform and tried to impale Hannah with my stare. I wanted her to feel my eyes in her back. After some time she turned around and glanced at me. Then she went on, talking to the driver. The journey continued. Once we'd passed Eppelheim, the rails were no longer in the surface of the road, but laid alongside on a graveled embankment. The car accelerated, with the regular clackety-clack of a train. I knew that this stretch continued through various places, and ended up in Schwetzingen. But I felt rejected, exiled from the real world in which people lived and worked and loved. It was as if I were condemned to ride forever in an empty car to nowhere. Then I saw another stop, a shelter in the middle of open country. I pulled the cord the conductors used to signal the driver to stop or start. The streetcar stopped. Neither Hannah nor the driver looked back at me when they heard the bell. As I got off, I thought they were looking at me and laughing, but I wasn't sure. Then the streetcar moved on, and I looked after it until it headed down into a dip and disappeared behind a hill. I was standing between the embankment and the road. There were fields around me, and fruit trees, and further on a nursery with greenhouses. The air was cool, and filled with the twittering of birds. Above the mountains, the pale sky shone pink. The trip on the streetcar had been like a bad dream. If I didn't remember its epilogue so vividly, I would actually be tempted to think of it as a bad dream. Standing at the streetcar stop, hearing the birds and watching the sun come up, was like an awakening. But waking from a bad dream does not necessarily console you. It can also make you fully aware of the horror you just dreamed, and even of the truth residing in that horror. I set off towards home in tears, and couldn't stop crying until I reached Eppelheim. I walked all the way back. I tried more than once to hitch a ride. When I was halfway there, the streetcar passed me. It was full. I didn't see Hannah. I was waiting for her on the landing outside her apartment at noon, miserable, anxious, and furious. "Are you cutting school again?" "I'm on vacation. What was going on this morning?" She unlocked the door, and I followed her into the apartment and into the kitchen. "What do you mean, what was going on this morning?" "Why did you behave as if you didn't know me? I behaved as if I didn't know you." She turned around and stared at me coldly. "You didn't want to know me, getting into the second car when you could see I was in the first. Why would I get up at 4:30 on my first day of vacation to ride to Schwetzingen? Just to surprise you, because I thought you'd be happy. I got into the second car—" "You poor baby, up at 4:30 and on your vacation, too." I had never seen her sarcastic before. She shook her head. "How should I know why you're going to Schwetzingen? How should I know why you choose not to know me? It's your business, not mine. Would you leave now?" I can't describe how furious I was. "That's not fair, Hannah. You knew, you had to know, that I only got in the car to be with you. How can you believe I didn't want to know you? If I didn't, I would not have got on at all." "Oh, leave me alone. I already told you what you do is your business, not mine." She had moved so that the kitchen table was between us. Everything in her look, her voice, and her gestures told me I was an intruder and should leave. I sat down on the sofa. She had treated me badly, and I had wanted to call her on it. But I hadn't got through to her. Instead, she was the one who'd attacked me, and I became uncertain. Could she be right? Not objectively, but subjectively? Must she have misunderstood me? Had I hurt her unintentionally against my will, but hurt her anyway? "I'm sorry, Hannah. Everything went wrong. I didn't mean to upset you, but it looks. You think it looks like you upset me? You don't have the power to upset me. and will you please go, finally? I've been working, I want to take a bath, and I want a little peace." She looked at me commandingly. When I didn't get up, she shrugged, turned around, ran water into the tub, and took off her clothes. Then I stood up and left. I thought I was leaving for good, but half an hour later I was back at her door. She let me in, and I said the whole thing was my fault. I had behaved thoughtlessly, inconsiderately, unlovingly. I understood that she was upset. I understood that she wasn't upset, because I couldn't upset her. I understood that I couldn't upset her, but that she simply couldn't allow me to behave that way to her. In the end, I was happy that she admitted I'd hurt her. So she wasn't as unmoved and uninvolved as she'd been making out after all. "Do you forgive me?" She nodded. "Do you love me?" She nodded again. "The tub is still full. Come, I'll bathe you." Later I wondered if she had left the water in the tub because she knew I would come back. If she had taken her clothes off because she knew I wouldn't be able to get that out of my head and that it would bring me back. If she had wanted to win a power game. After we'd made love and were lying next to each other and I told her why I'd got into the second car and not the first, she teased me. "You want to do it with me in the streetcar, too? Kid. Kid." It was as if the actual cause of our fight had been meaningless. But its results had meaning. I had not only lost this fight, I had caved in after a short struggle when she threatened to send me away and withhold herself. In the weeks that followed, I didn't fight at all. If she threatened, I instantly and unconditionally surrendered. I took all the blame. I admitted mistakes I hadn't made, intentions I'd never had. Whenever she turned cold and hard, I begged her to be good to me again, to forgive me and love me. Sometimes I had the feeling that she hurt herself when she turned cold and rigid. As if what she was yearning for was the warmth of my apologies, protestations, and entreaties. Sometimes I thought she just bullied me. But either way, I had no choice. I couldn't talk to her about it. Talking about our fights only led to more fighting. Once or twice I wrote her letters, but she didn't react. And when I asked her about them, she said, "Are you starting that again?" Chapter 11. Not that Hannah and I weren't happy again after the first day of Easter vacation. We were never happier than in those weeks of April. As sham as our first fight, and indeed all our fights were, everything that enlarged our ritual of reading, showering, making love, and lying beside each other did us good. Besides which, she had trumped herself with her accusation that I hadn't wanted to know her. When I wanted to be seen with her, she couldn't raise any fundamental objections. "So it was you who didn't want to be seen with me." She didn't want to have to listen to that. So the week after Easter, we set off by bike on a 4-day trip to Wimpfen, Amorbach, and Miltenberg. I don't remember what I told my parents. That I was doing the trip with my friend Matthias? With a group? That I was going to visit a former classmate? My mother was probably worried, as usual, and my father probably found, as usual, that she should stop worrying. Hadn't I just passed the class when nobody thought I could do it? While I was sick, I hadn't spent any of my pocket money. But that wouldn't be enough if I wanted to pay for Hannah as well. So I offered to sell my stamp collection to the stamp dealer next to the Church of the Holy Spirit. It was the only shop that said on the door that it purchased collections. The salesman looked through my album and offered me 60 marks. I made him look at my showpiece, a straight-edged Egyptian stamp with a pyramid that was listed in the catalog for 400 marks. He shrugged. If I cared that much about my collection, maybe I should hang on to it. Was I even allowed to be selling it? What did my parents say about it? I tried to bargain. If the stamp with the pyramid wasn't that valuable, I would just keep it. Then he could only give me 30 marks. So the stamp with the pyramid was valuable after all. In the end, I got 70 marks. I felt cheated, but I didn't care. I was not the only one with itchy feet. To my amazement, Hannah started getting restless days before we left. She went this way and that over what to take, and packed and repacked the saddlebag and rucksack I had got hold of for her. When I wanted to show her the route I had worked out on the map, she didn't want to look or even hear about it. "I'm too excited already. You'll have worked it out right anyway, kid." We set off on Easter Monday. The sun was shining and went on shining for 4 days. The mornings were cool, and then the days warmed up, not too warm for cycling, but warm enough to have picnics. The woods were carpets of green, with yellow-green, bright-green, bottle-green, blue-green, and black-green daubs, flecks, and patches. In the flatlands along the Rhine, the first fruit trees were already in bloom. In Odenwald, the first forsythias were out. Often we could ride side by side. Then we pointed out to each other the things we saw, the castle, the fishermen, the boat on the river, the tent, the family walking single file along the bank, the enormous American convertible with the top down. When we changed directions or roads, I had to ride ahead. She didn't want to have to bother with such things. Otherwise, when the traffic was too heavy, she sometimes rode behind me, and sometimes vice versa. Her bike had covered spokes, pedals, and gears, and she wore a blue dress with a big skirt that fluttered in her wake. It took me some time to stop worrying that the skirt would get caught in the spokes or the gears and she would fall off. After that, I liked watching her ride ahead of me. How I looked forward to the nights. I had imagined that we would make love, go to sleep, wake up, make love again, go to sleep again, wake up again, and so on, night after night. But the only time I woke up again was the first night. She lay with her back to me. I leaned over her and kissed her, and she turned on her back, took me into her, and held me in her arms. Kid. Kid. Then I fell asleep on top of her. The other nights we slept right through, worn out by the cycling, the sun, and the wind. We made love in the mornings. Hanna didn't just let me be in charge of choosing our direction and the roads to take. I was the one who picked out the inns where we spent the nights, registered us as mother and son, while she just signed her name, and selected our food from the menu for both of us. I like not having to worry about a thing for a change. The only fight we had took place in Amerbach. I had woken up early, dressed quietly, and crept out of the room. I wanted to bring up breakfast and also see if I could find a flower shop open where I could get a rose for Hanna. I had left a note on the night table. Good morning, bringing breakfast, be right back, or words to that effect. When I returned, she was standing in the room, trembling with rage, and white-faced. How could you just go like that? I put down the breakfast tray with the rose on it, and wanted to take her in my arms. Hanna, don't touch me! She was holding the narrow leather belt that she wore around her dress. She took a step backwards, and hit me across the face with it. My lip split, and I tasted blood. It didn't hurt. I was horror-struck. She swung again. But she didn't hit me. She let her arm fall, dropped the belt, and burst into tears. I had never seen her cry. Her face lost all its shape. Wide-open eyes, wide-open mouth, eyelids swollen after the first tears, red blotches on her cheeks and neck. Her mouth was making croaking, throaty sounds like the toneless cry when we made love. She stood there looking at me through her tears. I should have taken her in my arms, but I couldn't. I didn't know what to do. At home, none of us cried like that. We didn't hit, not even with our hands, let alone a leather belt. We talked. But what was I supposed to say now? She took two steps towards me, beat her fists against me, then clung to me. Now I could hold her. Her shoulders trembled. She knocked her forehead against my chest. Then she gave a deep sigh and snuggled into my arms. "Shall we have breakfast?" She let go of me. "My God, kid, look at you." She fetched a wet towel and cleaned my mouth and chin. "And your shirt is covered with blood." She took off the shirt and my pants, and we made love. "What was the matter? Why did you get so angry?" We were lying side by side, so satiated and content that I thought everything would be cleared up now. "What was the matter? What was the matter? You always ask such silly questions. You can't just leave like that."
"But I left you a note."
"Note?" I sat up. The note was no longer on the night table where I had left it. I got to my feet and searched next to the night table and underneath and under the bed and in it. I couldn't find it. "I don't understand. I wrote you a note saying I was going to get breakfast and I'd be right back."
"You did? I don't see any note."
"You don't believe me?"
"I'd love to believe you, but I don't see any note."
We didn't go on fighting. Had a gust of wind come and taken the note and carried it away to God knows where? Had it all been a misunderstanding? Her fury, my split lip, her wounded face, my helplessness? Should I have gone on searching for the note, for the cause of Hannah's fury, for the source of my helplessness? Read me something, kid. She cuddled up to me, and I picked up Eichendorff's Memoirs of a Good-for-Nothing, and continued from where I had left off. Memoirs of a Good-for-Nothing was easy to read aloud, easier than Emilia Galotti and Intrigues and Love. Again, Hannah followed everything eagerly. She liked the scattering of poems. She liked the disguises, the mix-ups, the complications and pursuits which the hero gets tangled up in Italy. At the same time, she held it against him that he's a good-for-nothing who doesn't achieve anything, can't do anything, and doesn't want to besides. She was torn in all directions. Hours after I stopped reading, she was still coming up with questions. Customs collector. Wasn't much of a job? Once again, the report on our fight has become so detailed that I would like to report on our happiness. The fight made our relationship more intimate. I had seen her crying. The Hannah who could cry was closer to me than the Hannah who was only strong. She began to show a soft side that I had never seen before. She kept looking at my split lip until it healed, and stroking it gently. We made love a different way. For a long time I had abandoned myself to her and her power of possession. Then I had also learned to take possession of her. On this trip and afterwards, we no longer merely took possession of each other. I have a poem that I wrote back then. As poetry, it's worthless. At the time, I was in love with Rilke and Ben, and I can see that I wanted to imitate them both. But I can also see how close we were at the time. Here is the poem. When we open ourselves, you yourself to me, and I myself to you. When we submerge, you into me, and I into you. When we vanish, into me you, and into you I. Then am I me, and you are you. Chapter 12. While I have no memory of the lies I told my parents about the trip with Hannah, I do remember the price I had to pay to stay alone at home the last week of vacation. I can't recall where my parents and my older brother and sister were going. The problem was my little sister. She was supposed to go and stay with a friend's family. But if I was going to be at home, she wanted to be at home as well. My parents didn't want that. So I was supposed to go and stay with a friend, too. As I look back, I find it remarkable that my parents were willing to leave me, a 15-year-old, at home alone for a week. Had they noticed the independence that had been growing in me since I met Hannah? Or had they simply registered the fact that I had passed the class despite the months of illness and decided that I was more responsible and trustworthy than I had shown myself to be until then? Nor do I remember being called on to explain the many hours I spent at Hannah's. My parents apparently believed that, now that I was healthy again, I wanted to be with my friends as much as possible, whether studying or just enjoying our free time. Besides, when parents have a pack of 4 children, their attention cannot cover everything, and tends to focus on whichever one is causing the most problems at the moment. I had caused problems for long enough. My parents were relieved that I was healthy, and would be moving up into the next class. When I asked my little sister what her price was for going to stay with her friend while I stayed home, she demanded jeans. We called them blue jeans back then, or studded pants, and a Nikki, which was a velour sweater. That made sense. Jeans were still something special at that time. They were chic, and they promised liberation from herringbone suits and big flowered dresses. Just as I had to wear my uncle's things, my little sister had to wear her big sister's. But I had no money. "Then steal them," said my little sister, with perfect equanimity. It was astonishingly easy. I tried on various jeans, took a pair her size with me into the fitting room, and carried them out of the store against my stomach under my wide suit pants. The sweater I stole from the big main department store. My little sister and I went in one day and strolled from stand to stand in the fashion department until we found the right stand and the right sweater. Next day I marched quickly through the department, seized the sweater, hid it under my suit jacket, and was outside again. The day after that I stole a silk nightgown for Hannah, was spotted by the store detective, ran for my life, and escaped by a hair. I didn't go back to the department store for years after that. Since our nights together on the trip, I had longed every night to feel her next to me, to curl up against her, my stomach against her behind and my chest against her back, to rest my hand on her breasts, to reach out for her when I woke up in the night, find her, push my leg over her legs, and press my face against her shoulder. A week alone at home meant 7 nights with Hannah. One evening I invited her to the house and cooked for her. She stood in the kitchen as I put the finishing touches on the food. She stood in the open double doors between the dining room and living room as I served. She sat at the round dining table where my father usually sat. She looked around. Her eyes explored everything. The Biedermeier furniture, the piano, the old grandfather clock, the pictures, the bookcases, the plates and cutlery on the table. When I left her alone to prepare dessert, she was not at the table when I came back. She had gone from room to room and was standing in my father's study. I leaned quietly against the doorpost and watched her. She let her eyes drift over the bookshelves that filled the walls, as if she were reading a text. Then she went to a shelf, raised her right index finger chest high, and ran it slowly along the backs of the books, moving to the next shelf, ran her finger further along from one spine to the next, pacing off the whole room. She stopped at the window, looked out into the darkness, at the reflection of the bookshelves, and at her own. It is one of the pictures of Hannah that has stayed with me. I have them stored away. I can project them on a mental screen and watch them, unchanged, unconsumed. There are long periods when I don't think about them at all. But they always come back into my head, and then I sometimes have to run them repeatedly through my mental projector and watch them. One is Hannah putting on her stockings in the kitchen. Another is Hannah standing in front of the tub, holding the towel in her outstretched arms. Another is Hannah riding her bike, with her skirt blowing in her slipstream. Then there is the picture of Hannah in my father's study. She's wearing a blue and white striped dress, what they called a shirtwaist back then. She looks young in it. She has run her finger along the backs of the books and looked into the darkness of the window. She turns to me, quickly enough that the skirt swings out around her legs for a moment before it hangs smooth again. Her eyes are tired. Are these books your father has just read, or did he write them too? I knew there was a book on Kant and another on Hegel that my father had written, and I searched for them and showed them to her. Read me something from them, please, kid. I didn't want to, but didn't like to refuse her either. I took my father's Kant book and read her a passage on analysis and dialectics that neither of us understood. Is that enough? She looked at me as though she had understood it all, or as if it didn't matter whether anything was understandable or not. Will you write books like that someday? I shook my head. Will you write other books? I don't know. Will you write plays? I don't know, Hannah. She nodded. Then we ate dessert and went to her apartment. I would have liked to sleep with her in my bed, but she didn't want to. She felt like an intruder in our house. She didn't say it in so many words, but in the way she stood in the kitchen, or in the open double doors, or walked from room to room, inspected my father's books, and sat with me at dinner. I gave her the silk nightgown. It was aubergine-colored, with narrow straps that left her shoulders and arms bare and came down to her ankles. It shone and shimmered. Hannah was delighted. She laughed and beamed. She looked down at herself, turned around, danced a few steps, looked at herself in the mirror, checked her reflection, and danced some more. That, too, is a picture of Hannah that has stayed with me. Chapter 13. I always experienced the beginning of a new school year as a watershed. Moving up from 10th to 11th grade was a major one. My class was disbanded among the 3 other parallel classes. Quite a few students had failed to make the grade, so 4 small classes were combined into 3 larger ones. My high school traditionally had taken only boys. When girls began to be accepted, there were so few of them to begin with that they were not divided equally among the parallel classes, but were assigned to a single class, then later to a second and a third, until they made up a third of each class. There were not enough girls in my year for any to be assigned to my former class. We were the 4th parallel class, and all boys, which is why we were the ones to be disbanded and reassigned, and not one of the other classes. We didn't find out about it until school began. The principal summoned us into a classroom and informed us about the why and how of our reassignment. Along with six others, I crossed the empty halls to the new classroom. We got the seats that were left over. Mine was in the second row. They were individual seats, but in pairs, divided into three rows. I was in the middle row. On my left, I had a classmate from my old class, Rudolf Bagen, a heavyset, calm, dependable chess and hockey player, with whom I hadn't ever spent any time in my old class, but who soon became a good friend. On my right, across the aisle, were the girls. My neighbor was Sophie. Brown hair, brown eyes, brown summer skin, with tiny golden hairs on her bare arms. After I'd sat down and looked around, she smiled at me. I smiled back. I felt good. I was excited about a new start in a new class, and the girls. I had observed my mates in 10th grade. Whether they had girls in their class or not, they were afraid of them, or kept out of their way, or showed off to them, or worshipped them. I knew my way around women, and could be comfortable and open in a friendly way. The girls liked that. I would get along with them well in the new class, which meant I'd get along with the boys, too. Does everyone feel this way? When I was young, I was perpetually overconfident or insecure. Either I felt completely useless, unattractive, and worthless, or that I was pretty much a success, and everything I did was bound to succeed. When I was confident, I could overcome the hardest challenges, but all it took was the smallest setback for me to be sure that I was utterly worthless. Regaining my self-confidence had nothing to do with success. Every goal I set myself, every recognition I craved, made anything I actually did seem paltry by comparison, and whether I experienced it as a failure or triumph was utterly dependent on my mood. With Hannah, things felt good for weeks, in spite of our fights, in spite of the fact that she pushed me away again and again I crawled to her. And so summer in the new class began well. I can still see the classroom. Right front, the door. Along the right-hand wall, the board with the clothes hooks. On the left, a row of windows looking onto the Heiligenberg. And, when we stood next to the glass at recess, down at the streets, the river, and the meadows on the opposite bank. In front, the blackboard. The stands for maps and diagrams, and the teacher's desk and chair on a foot-high platform. The walls had yellow oil paint on them to about head height, and above that, white. And from the ceiling hung two milky glass globes. There was not one superfluous thing in the room. No pictures, no plants, no extra chair, no cupboard with forgotten books and notebooks and colored chalk. When your eyes wandered, they wandered to what was outside the window, or to whoever was sitting next to you. When Sophie saw me looking at her, she turned and smiled at me. "Berg, Sophia may be a Greek name, but that is no reason for you to study your neighbor in a Greek lesson. Translate." We were translating the Odyssey. I had read it in German, loved it, and love it to this day. When it was my turn, it took me only seconds to find my place and translate. After the teacher had stopped teasing me about Sophie and the class had stopped laughing, it was something else that made me stutter. Nausicaa, white-armed and virginal, who in body and feature resembled the immortals. Should I imagine her as Hannah or as Sophie? It had to be one of the two. Chapter 14. When an airplane's engines fail, it is not the end of the flight. Airplanes don't fall out of the sky like stones. They glide on, the enormous multi-engined passenger jets, for 30-45 minutes, only to smash themselves up when they attempt a landing. The passengers don't notice a thing. Flying feels the same whether the engines are working or not. It's quieter, but only slightly. The wind drowns out the engines as it buffets the tail and wings. At some point, the earth or sea look dangerously close through the window. But perhaps the movie is on, and the stewards and air hostesses have closed the shades. Maybe the very quietness of the flight is appealing to the passengers. That summer was the glide path of our love, or rather of my love for Hannah. I don't know about her love for me. We kept up our ritual of reading aloud, showering, making love, and then lying together. I read her War and Peace, with all of Tolstoy's disquisitions on history, great men, Russia, love, and marriage. It must have lasted 40 or 50 hours. Again, Hannah became absorbed in the unfolding of the book. But it was different this time. She withheld her own opinions. She didn't make Natasha, Andre, and Pierre part of her world, as she had Louisa and Emilia, but entered their world the way one sets out on a long and dazzling journey, or enters a castle which one is allowed to visit, even stay in until one feels at home, but without ever really shedding one's inhibitions. All the things I had read to her before were already familiar to me. War and Peace was new for me, too. We took the long journey together. We thought up pet names for each other. She began not just to call me Kid, but gave me other attributes and diminutives, such as Frog or Toad, Puppy, Toy, and Rose. I stuck to Hannah, until she asked me, "Which animal do you see when you hold me and close your eyes and think of animals?" I closed my eyes and thought of animals. We were lying snuggled close together, my head on her neck, my neck on her breasts, my right arm underneath her, against her back, and my left hand on her behind. I ran my arms and hands over her broad back, her hard thighs, her firm ass, and also felt the solidity of her breasts and stomach against my neck and chest. Her skin was smooth and soft to the touch, the body beneath it strong and reliable. When my hand lay on her calf, I felt the constant twitching play of muscles. It reminded me of the way a horse twitches its hide to repel flies. A horse. A horse! She disentangled herself, sat up and stared at me, stared in shock. You don't like it? It came to me because you feel so good, smooth and soft and all firm and strong underneath. And because your calf twitches. I explained my association. She looked at the ripple of the muscles in her calf. Horse. She shook her head. I don't know. That wasn't how she usually was. Usually she was absolutely single-minded, whether in agreement or disagreement. Faced with her look of shock, I had been ready to take it all back if necessary, blame myself, and apologize. But now I tried to reconcile her to the horse. I could call you Cheval or Pony or Little Equus. When I think of horses, I don't think horse's teeth or horse face or whatever it is that worries you. I think of something good, warm, soft, strong. You're not a bunny or a kitten, and whatever there is in a tiger, that evil something, that's not you either. She lay down on her back, arms behind her head. Now it was me who sat up to look at her. She was staring into space. After a while she turned her face to me. Her expression was curiously naked. Yes, I like it when you call me horse, or those other horse names. Can you explain them to me? Once we went to the theater in the next town to see Schiller's Intrigues and Love. It was the first time Hannah had been to the theater, and she loved all of it, from the performance to the champagne at intermission. I put my arm around her waist and didn't care what people might think of us as a couple, and I was proud that I didn't care. At the same time, I knew that in the theater in our hometown, I would care. Did she know that, too? She knew that my life that summer no longer revolved around her, and school, and my studies. More and more, when I came to her in the late afternoon, I came from the swimming pool. That was where our class got together, did our homework, played soccer and volleyball and scat, and flirted. That was where our class socialized, and it meant a lot to me to be part of it and to belong. The fact that I came later than the others or left earlier, depending on Hannah's schedule, didn't hurt my reputation, but made me interesting. I knew that. I also knew that I wasn't missing anything, and yet I often had the feeling that absolutely everything could be happening while I wasn't there. There was a long stretch when I did not dare ask myself whether I would rather be at the swimming pool or with Hannah. But on my birthday in July, there was a party for me at the pool. And it was hard to tear myself away from it when they didn't want me to go. And then an exhausted Hannah received me in a bad mood. She didn't know it was my birthday. When I had asked her about hers and she had told me it was the 21st of October, she hadn't asked me when mine was. She was also no more bad-tempered than she always was when she was exhausted. But I was annoyed by her bad temper, and I wanted to be somewhere else, at the pool, away with my classmates, swept up in the exuberance of our talk, our banter, our games, and our flirtations. Then, when I proceeded to get bad-tempered myself, and we started a fight, and Hannah treated me like a non-entity, the fear of losing her returned, and I humbled myself and begged her pardon until she took me back. But I was filled with resentment. Chapter 15. Then I began to betray her. Not that I gave away any secrets or exposed Hannah. I didn't reveal anything that I should have kept to myself. I kept something to myself that I should have revealed. I didn't acknowledge her. I know that disavowal is an unusual form of betrayal. From the outside, it is impossible to tell if you are disowning someone or simply exercising discretion, being considerate, avoiding embarrassments and sources of irritation. But you, who are doing the disowning, you know what you're doing. And disavowal pulls the underpinnings away from a relationship just as surely as other more flamboyant types of betrayal. I no longer remember when I first denied Hannah. Friendships coalesced out of the casual ease of those summer afternoons at the swimming pool. Aside from the boy who sat next to me in school, whom I knew from the old class, the person I liked especially in the new class was Holger Schlüter, who, like me, was interested in history and literature, and with whom I quickly felt at ease. He also got along with Sophie, who lived a few blocks behind our house, which meant that we went to and from the swimming pool together. At first I told myself that I wasn't yet close enough to my friends to tell them about Hannah. Then I didn't find the right opportunity, the right moment, the right words. And finally it was too late to tell them about Hannah, to present her along with all my other youthful secrets. I told myself that talking about her so belatedly would misrepresent things, make it seem as if I had kept silent about Hannah for so long because our relationship wasn't right, and I felt guilty about it. But no matter what I pretended to myself, I knew that I was betraying Hannah when I acted as if I was letting my friends in on everything important in my life, but said nothing about Hannah. The fact that they knew I wasn't being completely open only made things worse. One evening, Sophie and I got caught in a thunderstorm on our way home, and took shelter under the overhang of a garden shed in Neuenheimerfeld, which had no university buildings on it then, just fields and gardens. It thundered, the lightning crackled, the wind came in gusts, and rain fell in big, heavy drops. At the same time, the temperature dropped a good 10 degrees. We were freezing, and I put my arm around her. "You know," she wasn't looking at me, but out at the rain.
"What?"
"You were sick with hepatitis for a long time. Is that what's on your mind? Are you afraid you won't really get well again? Did the doctor say something? And do you have to go to the clinic every day to get tests or transfusions?"
Hannah as illness. I was ashamed. But I really couldn't start talking about Hannah at this point. "No, Sophie, I'm not sick anymore. My liver is normal, and in a year I'll even be able to drink alcohol if I want. But I don't."
"What's
Talking about Hannah, I didn't want to say, "What's bothering me?" "There's another reason I arrive later, or leave earlier."
"Do you not want to talk about it, or is it that you want to, but you don't know how?"
Did I not want to, or didn't I know how? I didn't know the answer. But as we stood there, under the lightning, with the explosions of thunder rumbling almost overhead, and the pounding of the rain, both freezing, warming each other a little, I had the feeling that I had to tell her, of all people, about Hannah.
"Maybe I can tell you some other time."
But there never was another time.
Chapter 16. I never found out what Hannah did when she wasn't working and we weren't together. When I asked, she turned away my questions. We did not have a world that we shared. She gave me the space in her life that she wanted me to have. I had to be content with that. Wanting more, even wanting to know more, was presumption on my part. If we were particularly happy with each other, and I asked her something because at that moment it felt as if everything was possible and allowed, then she sometimes ducked my questions, instead of refusing outright to answer them.
"The things you ask, kid."
Or she would take my hand and lay it on her stomach.
"Are you trying to make holes in me?"
or she would count on her fingers. Laundry, ironing, sweeping, dusting, shopping, cooking, shake plums out of tree, pick up plums, bring plums home and cook them quick before the little one, and here she would take hold of the fifth finger of her left hand between her right thumb and forefinger, eats them all himself. I never met her unexpectedly on the street or in a store or a movie theater, although she told me she loved going to the movies, and in our first months together I always wanted to go with her, but she wouldn't let me. Sometimes we talked about films we had both seen. She went no matter what was showing, and saw everything, from German war and folk movies to westerns and new wave films, and I liked what came out of Hollywood, whether it was set in ancient Rome or the Wild West. There was one western in particular that we both loved, the one with Richard Widmark playing a sheriff who has to fight a duel next morning that he's bound to lose, and in the evening he knocks on Dorothy Malone's door. She's been trying, but failing, to get him to make a break for it. She opens up. "What do you want now? Your whole life in one night?" Sometimes Hannah teased me when I came to her full of desire with, "What do you want now? Your whole life in one hour?" Only once did I ever see Hannah by chance. It was the end of July, or the beginning of August, in the last few days before summer vacation. Hannah had been behaving oddly for days, moody and peremptory, and at the same time palpably under some kind of pressure that was absolutely tormenting her and left her acutely sensitive and vulnerable. She pulled herself together and held herself tight, as if to stop herself from exploding. When I asked what was upsetting her so, she snapped at me. That was hard for me to take. I felt rejected, but I also felt her helplessness, and I tried to be there for her and at the same time to leave her in peace. One day the pressure was gone. At first I thought Hannah was her usual self again. We had not started a new book after the end of War and Peace, but I had promised I'd see to it, and had brought several books to choose from. But she didn't want that. "Let me bathe you, kid." It wasn't summer's humidity that had settled on me like a heavy net when I came into the kitchen. Hannah had turned on the boiler for the bath water. She filled the tub, put in a few drops of lavender oil, and washed me. She wore her pale blue flowered smock with no underwear underneath. The smock stuck to her sweating body in the hot, damp air. She excited me very much. When we made love, I sensed that she wanted to push me to the point of feeling things I had never felt before, to the point where I could no longer stand it. She also gave herself in a way she had never done before. She didn't abandon all reserve, she never did that, but it was as if she wanted us to drown together. "Now go to your friends." She dismissed me, and I went. The heat stood solidly between the buildings, lay over the fields and gardens, and shimmered above the asphalt. I was numb. At the swimming pool, the shrieks of playing, splashing children reached me as if from far, far away. I moved through the world as if it had nothing to do with me, nor I with it. I dived into the milky, chlorinated water and felt no compulsion to surface again. I lay near the others, listening to them, and found what they said silly and pointless. Eventually the feeling passed. Eventually it turned into an ordinary afternoon at the swimming pool with homework and volleyball and gossip and flirting. I can't remember what it was I was doing when I looked up and saw her. She was standing 20 or 30 meters away, in shorts and an open blouse knotted at the waist, looking at me. I looked back at her. She was too far away for me to read her expression. I didn't jump to my feet and run to her. Questions raced through my head. Why was she at the pool? Did she want to be seen with me? Did I want to be seen with her? Why had we never met each other by accident? What should I do? Then I stood up, and in that briefest of moments in which I took my eyes off her, she was gone. Hannah in shorts, with the tails of her blouse knotted, her face turned towards me but with an expression I cannot read at all. That is another picture I have of her. Chapter 17. Next day she was gone. I came at the usual time and rang the bell. I looked through the door. Everything looked the way it always did. I could hear the clock ticking. I sat down on the stairs once again. During our first few months I had always known what line she was working on, even though I had never repeated my attempt to accompany her or even pick her up afterwards. At some point I had stopped asking, stopped even wondering. It hadn't even occurred to me until now. I used the telephone booth at the Wilhelmsplatz to call the streetcar company, was transferred from one person to the next, and finally was told that Hannah Schmitz had not come to work. I went back to Bahnhofstrasse, asked at the carpenter's shop in the yard for the name of the owner of the building, and got a name and address in Kirchheim. I rode over there. "Frau Schmitz? She moved out this morning."
"And her furniture?"
"It's not her furniture."
"How long did she live in the apartment?"
"What's it to you?" The woman who had been talking to me through a window in the door slammed it shut. In the administration building of the streetcar company, I talked my way through to the personnel department. The man in charge was friendly and concerned. "She called me this morning early enough for us to arrange for a substitute and said that she wouldn't be coming back, period." He shook his head. "2 weeks ago she was sitting there in your chair and I offered to have her trained as a driver, and she throws it all away." It took me some days to think of going to the citizens' registration office. She had informed them she was moving to Hamburg, but without giving an address. The days went by, and I felt sick. I took pains to make sure my parents and my brothers and sisters noticed nothing. I joined in the conversation at table a little, ate a little, and when I had to throw up, I managed to make it to the toilet. I went to school and to the swimming pool. I spent my afternoons there in an out-of-the-way place where no one would look for me. My body yearned for Hannah, but even worse than my physical desire was my sense of guilt. Why hadn't I jumped up immediately when she stood there and run to her? This one moment summed up all my half-heartedness of the past months, which had produced my denial of her and my betrayal. Leaving was her punishment. Sometimes I tried to tell myself that it wasn't her I had seen. How could I be sure it was her when I hadn't been able to make out the face? If it had been her, wouldn't I have had to recognize her face? So couldn't I be sure it wasn't her at all? But I knew it was her. She stood and looked, and it was too late. Part 2. Chapter 1. After Hannah left the city, it took a while before I stopped watching for her everywhere, before I got used to the fact that afternoons had lost their shape, and before I could look at books and open them without asking myself whether they were suitable for reading aloud. It took a while before my body stopped yearning for hers. Sometimes I myself was aware of my arms and legs groping for her in my sleep, and my brother reported more than once at table that I had called out Hannah in the night. I can also remember classes at school when I did nothing but dream of her, think of her. The feeling of guilt that had tortured me in the first weeks gradually faded. I avoided her building, took other routes, and 6 months later my family moved to another part of town. It wasn't that I forgot Hannah, but at a certain point the memory of her stopped accompanying me wherever I went. She stayed behind, the way a city stays behind as a train pulls out of the station. It's there, somewhere behind you, and you could go back and make sure of it. But why should you? I remember my last years of school and my first years at university as happy. Yet I can't say very much about them. They were effortless. I had no difficulty with my final exams at school, or with the legal studies that I chose because I couldn't think of anything else I really wanted to do. I had no difficulty with friendships, with relationships, or the end of relationships. I had no difficulty with anything. Everything was easy. Nothing weighed heavily. Perhaps that is why my bundle of memories is so small. Or do I keep it small? I also wonder if my memory of happiness is even true. If I think about it more, plenty of embarrassing and painful situations come to mind, and I know that even if I had said goodbye to my memory of Hannah, I had not overcome it. Never to let myself be humiliated or humiliate myself after Hannah. Never to take guilt upon myself or feel guilty. Never again to love anyone whom it would hurt to lose. I didn't formulate any of this as I thought back then, but I know that's how I felt. I adopted a posture of arrogant superiority. I behaved as if nothing could touch or shake or confuse me. I got involved in nothing, and I remember a teacher who saw through this and spoke to me about it. I was arrogantly dismissive. I also remember Sophie. Not long after Hannah left the city, Sophie was diagnosed with tuberculosis. She spent 3 years in a sanatorium, returning just as I went to university. She felt lonely and sought out contact with her old friends. It wasn't hard for me to find a way into her heart. After we slept together, she realized I wasn't interested in her. In tears, she asked, "What's happened to you? What's happened to you?" I remember my grandfather during one of my last visits before his death. He wanted to bless me, and I told him I didn't believe in any of that, and didn't want it. It is hard for me to imagine that I felt good about behaving like that. I also remember that the smallest gesture of affection would bring a lump to my throat, whether it was directed at me or at someone else. Sometimes all it took was a scene in a movie. This juxtaposition of callousness and extreme sensitivity seemed suspicious, even to me. Chapter 2. When I saw Hannah again, it was in a courtroom. It wasn't the first trial dealing with the camps, nor was it one of the major ones. Our professor, one of the few at that time who were working on the Nazi past and the related trials, made it the subject of a seminar in the hope of being able to follow the entire trial with the help of his students and evaluate it. I can no longer remember what it was he wanted to examine, confirm, or disprove. I do remember that we argued the prohibition of retroactive justice in the seminar. Was it sufficient that the ordinances under which the camp guards and enforcers were